a gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources. Where KSL offers Utah deeper insights on the news. Host Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason and elevates the conversation on issues crucial to our community on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Well, everybody's been talking about electric vehicles and what that might do to help the environment, and will it really, and what is government's role in all of that? To help us break all of that down, Philip Prezzetti, who, of course, is a resident senior fellow at our friends over at R Street Institute. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's break this down a little bit. We almost need our Think Again music on for this, because sometimes when government incentivizes certain things, you expect a certain outcome, and sometimes that's not quite what happens. Tell us what's going on as it relates to electric vehicles.
I think the simple answer is that my colleagues and I did some research, and what we found is we've really been subsidizing electric vehicles all along. The simple way of breaking this down is all these policies for subsidizing EVs say, hey, you know, if you drive a vehicle this much and then you have an electric vehicle versus a conventional vehicle, the EV is cleaner. When households are consuming new vehicles, they're not always replacing a primary vehicle or driving as much as the government expects. Very often it's a household that has two or even more vehicles. And very often these EV purchases are actually replacing a second vehicle, and it's not utilized as much. The reason this is an important aspect is because an EV has very high emissions associated with its manufacturing compared to a conventional vehicle, but has a lower emissions for each mile that it's driven. So if you're not driving these cars enough, then you're not actually getting an emissions benefit. And what we found is, sometimes there are households that are probably not even getting any emission benefit at all. If you have a two-vehicle household and you need to replace one of those with an EV, you'd have to hold on to it for about 10 to 11 years, and you'd have to drive it at least 70,000 miles before you even start getting a net benefit. But you compare that to a household that might have no vehicle and buys a new one, it's much easier to get a benefit. You'd only have to hold on to it for about 2 to 3 years and drive it 28,000 miles. So the subsidies really need to start reflecting utilization instead of just rewarding households for buying an electric vehicle.
Yeah, and just explain that for us a little bit in terms of that manufacturing impact. I think a lot of people just think electric vehicles, that's going to be better, it's going to be cleaner. But talk to us just a little bit, kind of the backstory there in terms of what is the manufacturing environmental impact as it relates to electric vehicles.
Yeah, so an electric vehicle is basically a big battery, a lithium-ion battery with four electric motors on the wheels. And that, you know, might seem pretty simple, but that requires a huge amount of minerals that have to be extracted, a lot of metals, copper and lithium and cobalt. And actually getting that much material, it's much more emissions intensive than a conventional vehicle. It's about six times as many minerals required for a EV compared to a conventional vehicle. And because of that, you end up with this really high manufacturing cost and production and pollution input. But every mile that it's driven is just way cleaner than the conventional vehicle. So you can kind of think of it as, all right, you know, if I'm driving this EV a lot, then I get a cleaner life cycle emission profile. But if the conventional vehicle is not being driven as much compared to an EV that would also not be driven as much, then the EV is just never going to overtake that. It's never going to compensate for its initial manufacturing emissions, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And then what about on the back end? Is that factored in at all in terms of, obviously, these batteries do have an environmental impact in terms of what you do with them at the back end? Is there any component in there that makes it better or worse?
You know, that's something that we're actually looking into as well, because there's a big debate as to how long do these batteries actually last, how long before they have to be replaced, which can be a very expensive repair for a new vehicle. And right now, EVs are so new into the market that we just don't have a lot of understanding of how long people hold on to their EVs, and if these potential repair costs associated with the batteries are maybe making it so that people can't keep them as long. But that's going to be future research, so stay tuned for that. But I think you're right to point out that we're just not really considering all of the aspects of vehicle ownership when we design these programs.
Yeah, and then let's take it all the way to the subsidy component in terms of government weighing in. We know often when government weighs in or provides subsidies, sometimes that spurs things on, and sometimes it actually inhibits some of the innovation because the government ends up picking winners and losers. How are we seeing that play out in the electric vehicle space?
Well, we know that EV demand is growing even without the subsidies. So it's mostly a lot of wealthy households that are buying EVs, which is great. We want people to buy vehicles where they think they're going to utilize it or there's going to be an emission benefit. But the challenge with the subsidy structure is it's not really targeted towards an outcome. It's not really saying, okay, if you're utilizing this EV this much, then you get rewarded for the environmental benefit. It's just saying, hey, if you buy an EV, here's a big chunk of money. And the challenge with that is you're not going to get the incentives aligned to necessarily get the environmental benefit. And if it's a rich household that's just buying a second or even third or fourth car that's an EV and just having it sit in the driveway, you're actually spending money on something that gives you no benefit when you could have spent that money on some alternative, transportation emission reduction. Hybrids, for example, I think are not really subsidized, but in most cases can get you much more emissions benefit compared to the same sort of government policies that are supporting EVs. So it's just something we need to really think about is, are we really getting as much out of these programs as we think we are?
Yeah. And what's on the horizon as it relates to some of these subsidies and kind of where the market is and where you see things going?
Well, Build Back Better, which maybe will be resurrected in the future, who knows, they wanted to increase the subsidies. They wanted to have about up to $12,500 per vehicle subsidy. But the structure, again, was not targeted towards utilization. And when the Congressional Budget Office looked into what they expected the uptake of the subsidy would be, it showed that there's basically no improvement from the subsidy. So I think, we're bringing it down to, okay, does the subsidy actually increase EV adoption? That's a bit debatable. We're seeing that people make vehicle purchase decisions based on a whole array of factors, not just cost. And we're not really sure if the subsidies get to where we need to go. But we do know that people are buying EVs, much, much more rapidly than we were before. But if we want to think about climate change, this is also a global problem. Yeah. So it's great that we're moving in that direction, but we're still not even close to getting it to a global, electrification of transportation sector. Oil demand is still very high projected into the future. So we're not there yet. And it's not only going to be just these programs that can overcome that either.
Yeah. Great insight as always. Philip Rossetti, resident senior fellow, focuses on all things related to energy for R Street Institute. Phil, great insight today. This is one I know we'll be talking about again in the future. But great research, great insight. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, what does Washington need to do differently to bring down inflation? Utah Representative Blake Moore joins us next right here on KSL News Radio.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband, and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.